From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a letter to the Senate today, CEOs of 145 companies call on their lawmakers to back bills requiring background checks on all gun sales and to back more so-called red flag laws, which let courts decide if guns should be taken from people deemed a risk to themselves or others. The letter comes after those two horrible mass shootings within 2 days last month, and after the White House turned the focus away from gun control and towards the mental health of a shooter. The CEOs include the heads of Twitter, Airbnb, Condé Nast, and Ambition, a sales coaching and gamification software company based in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Travis Truitt is CEO. Travis, why did you sign this letter?
You know, I'm born and raised in East Tennessee in Knoxville, and I've grown up getting guns for my birthday. I've grown up hunting with my dad and brother. I've always grown up with guns, respecting guns, and enjoying using guns within my hobbies. But with that said, I'm frustrated. And the reason I signed the letter is what feels like an inability for our country today to take any kind of action, let alone have any real dialogue around this issue.
Now, we're hearing that this decision by CEOs across the country led to a lot of internal debate. How about at your company?
You know, it is interesting. Even though our company is in the South, it is in a very conservative and Republican state, I think that we've all kind of started to reach the same conclusion, regardless of our politics, that something does need to happen. And that while a lot of us, similar to myself, have grown up with guns and that enjoy hunting, there needs to be a change. And at the very least, there needs to be real long-term dialogue about this issue.
Well, is there also conversation about the fact that what you are suggesting, expanded background checks, you know, for sales at gun shows and sales between, let's say, people, family members, and red flag laws so that if someone is desperately afraid that a loved one may commit suicide, for instance, with a gun, they can call the police and go to court and have it taken away, that those actions you're calling for probably won't at all affect whether or not you can hunt. It sounds like many of your workers agree, too, or at least people in your company are starting to see that as well. Is that what you're saying?
It is, yeah. I think so. You know, I have a pretty diverse family in that I have family that is living today in rural Appalachia, in, you know, western North Carolina, all the way up to, you know, big city Cleveland, Ohio. And what is starting to turn, I'm starting to see from a family perspective, is people on, in my case, certainly both sides of the aisle, starting to see this as a real problem and starting to actually say, this is something that we need to talk about and that we need to address. And then again, I think from a company perspective, the same thing. And so I do think that we are really close to this becoming a issue that we will, as a country, do something about. And, you know, I signed the letter to hopefully continue to bring this to the forefront.
Well, most polling shows that Americans back the policies you're calling for, above 90% of Americans. A week ago, Walmart, the largest retailer and employer in the country, of course, the site of that terrible shooting in El Paso where 22 were killed, wrote its own letter to Congress pushing for starting a debate over reauthorizing an assault weapons ban. It also removes certain ammunition and guns from its shelves. It discourages open carry in its stores. You have Citigroup, Bank of America. This year, they ended their lending and banking relationships with manufacturers. They declined to sign the letter because they were rebuked by Republican lawmakers after they did what they did. Louisiana passed a law preventing the banks from working on bond offerings for that state. Are you worried about a backlash?
I certainly am. And, you know, obviously it's my fiduciary responsibility to protect my company. But I do think that we are at a inflection point and a tipping point in America where it is time to put people over profits. And when you have something to lose, but you're still willing to stand up for what you believe in, I think is when change can happen, real change can happen. And that's why I'm really excited to have signed this letter, you know, sharing it with all these massive worldwide companies is that, yeah, these are companies that have something to lose. And we're still willing to put our names on a document saying that something needs to change. And that's where I'm optimistic.
Real quick, the Democratic candidate Beto O'Rourke has a plan calling on banks and credit card companies to refuse to service the purchase of assault-style weapons, just assault-style weapons, How far would you go? I don't know if your company works with any companies that sell assault-style weapons, just that kind of a weapon. But if so, would you stop working with them?
Yeah, so we've certainly had internal debates about servicing customers that we might have moral issues with. For example, we've actually discussed and decided not to work with certain cigarette manufacturers. And while we have not had an opportunity to work with or the potential to work with a assault-style weapons manufacturing company, I can promise you it would be a debate within Ambition, and we would make a decision based on what the people of Ambition feel comfortable doing.
Yeah. That's Travis Truitt. He's CEO of Ambition. This is a sales, coaching, and gamification software company based in Chattanooga, Tennessee. He signed a letter along with other CEOs calling on Congress to increase background checks and red flag laws. Travis, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Well, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said today that President Trump has no plans to meet with the Iranian president while he's in New York for the United Nations General Assembly later this month. Mnuchin also insisted there will be no change in the administration's maximum pressure policy on Tehran after the departure of the president's national security advisor, John Bolton, earlier this week. Let's bring in Jim Walsh, here now security analyst with MIT Security Studies Program. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good to be with you.
Good to have you here. And John Bolton was a hardliner on Iran, skeptical of engagement, but President Trump has said he's open to a meeting with the Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. What do you think? Will there be one? What do you make of Mnuchin's comments?
Well, I will say this, that for the first 3 years of the Trump administration, I would have guessed that neither Iran nor the administration would want to meet. I have since, in the past 4 months, met with Iranian officials who displayed a shocking, to me, openness to trying to improve this relationship. I didn't expect them to say that. And now we hear the similar noises coming from the administration. So it's possible. It's possible. But there's still a lot of political and psychological obstacles in the way. But I haven't heard any of that before. This is the first time I think there's a real possibility of that.
Do you think that the end result could be a deal that looks exactly like the Iranian nuclear deal that President Obama signed but has President Trump's name on it?
I think the most likely outcome, because we don't have a lot of time, you know, it took 3 years to negotiate the Iran deal, all lots of complexities and details. So I think you're more likely to get a North Korea-style interim agreement that says, hey, we'll stop banning the sale of your oil if you stop doing a couple of things here and there, and we'll just try to find an equilibrium and hold on to that to the end of the election.
What about with North Korea? The president yesterday said Bolton hurt his efforts to cut a deal with North Korea's Kim Jong-un on nuclear weapons. What do you think will happen now with North Korea?
I think you know, we don't know what's inside the leader of inside the leader's mind here. I'm talking about Kim, not Trump. I've been predicting since the beginning we'll get a third summit. I think we're going to have a third summit, and that's where the rubber will meet the road. I think the North Koreans think that they're sort of in the driver's seat here. You know, when you go into diplomacy, the question is who wants it more? And the closer we come to an election that could be close, the more the president will want to get a deal. And that gives, you know, leverage to the North Koreans.
On Afghanistan, Bolton disagreed with the president's plan to meet with the Taliban at Camp David. Trump ended up canceling that meeting after a Taliban attack last week killed an American soldier. Here's the president speaking at the Pentagon yesterday.
They thought they would use this attack to show strength. But actually, what they showed is unrelenting weakness. The last 4 days, we have hit our enemy harder than they have ever been hit before, and that will continue.
What do you think that Bolton's departure means for the war in Afghanistan?
Well, I think let's step back. There are two pieces here. We're going to have a new national security advisor. So part of the question, answer to the question is who that person is. Are they a bureaucratic street fighter? Are they a conciliator? Are they a hawk or a dove? Do they see their role as advocacy for their own policy or coordination? So the big question will be who will be the next national security advisor? But the second piece of this that really matters is what is the environment in which that person is working, the national security decision-making process? And that appears to me to be broken, right? So what's going to happen to all those Bolton staffers who are still sitting in their chairs?
Some of them have already left.
Yes, and they will leave. So we will have had a third national security advisor, a third set of new staff members to come in with whoever that person is, and a process in which many of the key players are acting or where the roles are not filled. And so part of the issue is who he brings in. But the second issue is the system, and the system seems broken to me.
Do you expect a dove or a hawk in that role next?
I expect a loyalist.
That's a Trump loyalist.
Yes. And so the answer is it could be hawk or dove.
It's whatever the president wants.
Exactly. And the president himself can shift. We've seen him shift positions, you know, authorizing a missile strike, pulling back at the last minute. He's not defined by ideology. He could pursue war. He could pursue peace. All those things are on the table. And so the person he's going to want is not going to be a person who has set policy preferences, but rather someone who's going to support him.
That is Jim Walsh, Here Now security analyst with MIT Security Studies Program. Jim, thank you.
Thank you.
We've been acknowledging some of America's shameful history of, well, frankly, mob rule. We learned about the 1917 Bisbee, Arizona deportation, 1,300 mine workers, largely immigrants, forced into boxcars, dropped far into the desert without food or water. And there were, of course, massacres, the Tulsa, Oklahoma race massacre of 1921, hundreds of blacks killed by whites. But a couple of years before that, 1919, what's known as the Red Summer, across the country, hundreds of African Americans died at the hands of white mobs in Chicago, Washington, D.C., Charleston, South Carolina, and Elaine, Arkansas, where estimates run from 100 to hundreds of blacks were killed, the largest number in that terrible summer. In this 100th anniversary year, a memorial to the victims of the Elaine massacre is being erected in Phillips County. It hasn't been an easy process. Let's bring in Chester Johnson, who's white. He believes his grandfather, Alonzo Lonnie Birch, took part in the massacre. And Chester is co-chair of the Elaine Massacre Memorial Committee. Chester Johnson, welcome.
Well, thank you.
And also with us, Kyle Miller. Four of his ancestors, relatively wealthy young black men, were pulled off a train, killed during the massacre. Kyle is now the director of the Delta Cultural Center in Helena, Arkansas. Kyle Miller, welcome to you as well.
Welcome to you as well, too.
And start with you, Kyle. Did you know about this growing up? Because we learned in Tulsa many blacks didn't. The survivors, they wanted to keep surviving, so they didn't talk about it. What about you?
I knew bits and pieces. My dad would often say the Elaine riots, and he would make a minimal reference to it. I knew it was something significant. I didn't know all the details. Mm. And then when I got a little bit older, probably a preteen, he then began to share even more, and he began to share that we had relatives that had actually died in the massacre, but were not actually participating in it.
Yeah. Well, they participated by being victims of it, which is what happened to most of the African Americans. With just the killings began after a meeting of black sharecroppers. They were looking to join a union to get better working conditions. A sheriff's deputy showed up with a security guard. Shots were fired. No one knows who started it, but the sheriff's deputy was killed, and the sheriff then went and organized a white posse who went out and murdered men, women, children. Chester, when did you start hearing about this, and why did you think your grandfather was involved?
It was much later that I learned about the Elaine race massacre. In 2008, I wrote the litany for Offense and Apology when the Episcopal Church, National Episcopal Church, formally apologized for its role in transatlantic slavery and related evils. And as I was doing a lot of my research, I came across this book that had been written by Ida B. Wells Barnett called The Arkansas Race Riot. And in that, there was a reference to the to Phillips County and this terrible event with so many African Americans perishing. And I grew up one county removed from Phillips County, and I grew up knowing nothing about this. And I began to do research into it, and I realized that a story that my own mother had told me about my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, coalesced with what I was reading in Ida B. Wells Barnett.
What did you think, Chester? Someone, you know, your flesh and blood.
Well, even beyond that, my father died when I was one, and I lived with my maternal grandparents for the first few years of my life because my mother didn't do very well. And my caretaker was Lonnie Birch. And we were very close. I mean, he took care of me 24 hours a day. And then later I find that that he had participated in this terrible event. And, you know, when you're confronted with that, you realize that maybe I can somehow reconcile the wonderful person that I knew who cared for me so deeply with this person who participated in the massacre. And over time, I realized I couldn't do that, that he would forever remain two separate people.
Well, you've been part of, you know, getting this memorial to this event built. Is that atonement? I mean, how do you feel personal guilt about this? I mean,
Really, it's a complicated issue.
Yeah.
I believe in something that's called damaged heritage. Not necessarily guilt, but that we inherit a history that we did not make, but yet we are party to it. And that undoubtedly plays a role in the way in which I look at this at this moment in history.
Kyle, I wonder what you're thinking or feeling listening to Chester.
Thinking about how even in my family, how the results of the massacre, how it shaped us and shaped our family. You know, my grandfather, because of the massacre, my family, his mother and father sent him to Boston to a boarding school when he was a young boy. And so he stayed there and then he went to college and then went to medical school. But it's particularly interesting because when he came back, there was almost a detachment, and we see now it was a part of his personality that even my father never could quite reconcile. And now, as I understand the history and the events of the massacre, I understand how he's shaped to be that, because him being a young boy, not really quite understanding everything that was going on, and then being sent off from his family, it created a detachment that had a ripple effect in our family for years to come.
Well, especially if people couldn't talk about it. But I'm also thinking, too, I mean, that's the most important thing, how people related to each other, that the family was shattered, I'm sure, four great uncles pulled from this train. But we hear that they were relatively wealthy young black men. And I wonder if you think about the disruption. I mean, it disrupted the financial futures of all of the people in Elaine.
It definitely had an economic impact. One of the brothers there in Helena had an automotive dealership, and the other was a dentist. Yeah, so you have a dentistry business with, he also had a drugstore as well. That was, you know, totally disintegrated because of the incident, along with the car dealership. And D.A. Johnson, who was the dentist, who was married to my great aunt, after the massacre, she moved away and she never came back to Phillips County, never.
Yeah, that's a generation of building up businesses and income that was lost. And I want to ask you, Kyle, I understand that there were some African Americans in the area, and Chester, I'm going to ask you about this as well, who weren't as interested in a monument. They said, you know what, this might assuage you and make some of the whites feel better that they did something, but what we want is reparations. And where do you weigh in on that?
Well, concerning reparations, I think that there are some valid discussions and arguments to be made, both, you know, for reparations. This is one piece, you know, and I think that's how we have to look at it. It's one piece of the puzzle in building upon a foundation of hopefully even greater things to come.
Yeah. And Chester, I want to give you a chance to respond to that, because I know that there were some people who were not in favor of what you wanted to do. They, you know, some people I've read expressed feelings of, well, that might make you feel better, but it does nothing for what was lost for my family.
Well, I was actually surprised by the number of white people who indicated that they would prefer that this memorial not go up. And they had general issues with it in terms of, is this going to raise ill feelings, particularly among African Americans.
Dig up the past. Dig up the past, right?
Dig up the past. Yeah. Leave it alone. Mm-hmm. But I agree with Kyle on this, that what the purpose of this memorial is different than the issue of reparations. But the purpose of this memorial, or certainly on the front phase of it, is to raise an awareness, to also lead toward a level of reconciliation coming out of that awareness.
Well, Kyle Miller, just one last question to you. 1919, 100 years ago, but is there anyone in your family alive who knew your great uncles, those four young men who were murdered, who you know, maybe for them going to this memorial will maybe heal something? Is there anyone alive who knew them?
No. However, I will say this. You know, my great aunt, who was married to D.A. Johnston, who was one of the brothers who was murdered, after the massacre, she moved to Chicago, and like I said, she never came back. And it was only until this past year at a family reunion that that side of the family ever came to Helena, to Phillips County. And that was the first time they had ever been to Phillips County in almost 100 years. And so that was a whole population of our family that we've now connected to as a result of the moving towards the monument. And they'll be there in September.
That's Kyle Miller, the director of the Delta Cultural Center in Helena, Arkansas. And we've also been speaking with Chester Johnson, co-chair of the Elaine Massacre Memorial Committee. Chester, Kyle, thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for giving us this time.
Athletes at California colleges could hire agents and sign endorsement deals under a bill the state Senate sent to Governor Gavin Newsom yesterday. The Fair Pay to Play Act sets up a confrontation with the NCAA that could jeopardize powerhouse sports programs like USC, UCLA, Stanford. But it has some high power support. LeBron James tweeted, "This law is a game changer," urging California residents to call their lawmakers. Bernie Sanders retweeted James and wrote, "College athletes are workers. Pay them." Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. But Mike, not everyone is happy. What's the opposition saying?
No, because I think when you say it could jeopardize major programs and you listed those California schools, I think that the programs that it could jeopardize are Ohio State, Penn State, Florida State, because there is a plausible rationale that if this bill goes into effect and is taken to its logical conclusion, it really threatens the underpinnings of the NCAA, which is your only compensation is your scholarship. And we also find that that doesn't always cover all room and board. Right. So you have a situation where there's 58 schools. There are 58 schools in California and some of the biggest programs in the country. They can propose to a superstar athlete, come here, and a car dealer might want to sign you up and you can make untold fortunes, or at least enough to pay for pizza. Same kid cannot get that deal outside of California. Therefore, it could wreck the whole system. Yeah. This is what the NCAA is worried about.
Well, when you talk about pay, though, I mean, we've read that it could be pay them as an employee. You know, what does pay mean?
Pay means actual compensation, which is important because the NCAA has always maintained that pay meant scholarship. I think that many people can see a rationale where there is a superstar transcendent player. A lot of people would pay for him to endorse their product. But what about the backup offensive lineman who gets, quote unquote, a marketing deal? And really all it becomes is a backdoor way to just pay players to go to the school.
Well, but on the other side of the equation, some people are saying, first, what about her? You know, the athlete that maybe will only have her earning power in college. Some people are mentioning Cheryl Miller, you know,
right,
great player. Or, you know, what about keeping kids in college? LeBron James, you know, what about this enticement to, you know, let kids have some sort of endorsement deal so that they stay in school?
Yeah, just the fact that there are documented cases of players who were homeless, they go to a college, they win a national championship, their parents are still homeless, like while they're doing that and generating millions for the school and billions for their sport. And so maybe if you just give some money, those players will stay in college longer. Although I don't know that there's going to be enough money to counterbalance the fact that the pros pay you millions of dollars. As far as the gender part of it, I can see it cutting both ways. So that argument is one of the state senators, one of the state legislators there in California was a high school teammate of Cheryl Miller. She pointed out Cheryl Miller, widely acknowledged to be a better athlete, a better basketball player than her brother Reggie Miller, the Hall of Famer, both Hall of Famers, by the way. But Cheryl Miller didn't have these opportunities. There was no WNBA. So if you allow for some sort of, as they call it, fair pay to play, female athletes will benefit more than they have in the past.
All right. Another argument is that the NCAA is working on a plan of its own. Let's wait and see what they come up with. We're going to be speaking to the NCAA officials tomorrow about the Fair Pay to Play Act, so we'll take a look at that. Meanwhile, we'll follow this with Mike Pesca, Here Knows sports analyst, host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
More than a dozen state attorneys general are objecting to that tentative settlement of up to $12 billion reached yesterday with Purdue Pharma, the maker of the opioid OxyContin, and the Sackler family, which owns the company. More than 2,000 state, county, and local governments sued. The deal, which is still being finalized, would require the Sackler family to give up control of Purdue, which would declare bankruptcy, and future revenue from the sale of OxyContin and overdose antidotes would go into a trust fund to help communities struggling with addiction. Well, one of the states objecting is Massachusetts, and Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey joins us on the phone. Attorney General Healey, welcome.
Hey, Robin. Great to be with you.
Well, you were in the lead on this. Your lawsuit was the first to name Purdue Pharma and the Sacklers. It laid out how they pushed OxyContin, pressured doctors. You revealed damning emails that showed company officials led by Richard Sackler blamed the addicted victims. Why aren't you accepting this deal that seems to punish the Sacklers?
Well, I'll tell you why. And in fact, I'm joined by a majority of states. The fact of the matter is, though, there seems to be some reporting to the contrary. The fact of the matter is this, Robin. Mm-hmm. The majority of states are rejecting this proposed deal.
And why?
And I'll tell you why. Yeah. Well, for several reasons. First of all, it's not worth nearly what they say it is. We know from Purdue's own documents that it could be worth as little as $4 billion, not the $10 to $12 billion that they are trying to purport this to be. The other thing is this, Robin, and I think this is really important for our state and for the number of states that followed our lead and sued the Sacklers individually, the company that directed and owned and controlled Purdue Pharma. The Sacklers would like you to believe that they're cutting a check for $3 billion for this deal. They're not. Over the last few decades, they've made billions of dollars from the sale of OxyContin. But they're not giving that money back. At least as we understand this settlement, as it's been proposed, not a dime of the money that they made from selling Oxy would go towards this settlement. And I think that their failure to actually pay up and disgorge some of the profits they made, have any skin in the game, is something that we absolutely have to reject. Yeah. There's also no acknowledgement of wrongdoing. And finally, we want to make sure that all the documents in Purdue's control are made available to the public. So much of this is about accountability and ultimately about justice, and part of it is the transparency that we need.
So the Sacklers' personal fortune is estimated at $13 billion. You're saying that you want to ensure that this is money that's coming from the Sacklers. And again, no admission of wrongdoing. But do you worry that in pushing for more, the deal will fall apart? You won't have anything.
Look, I respect decisions of other states. I will tell you why it is unacceptable for Massachusetts. First of all, we believe that they are overselling this to the public, the actual worth of this deal, that it's worth nowhere close to $10 to $12 billion. And as I say, Purdue, which is on the brink of bankruptcy, from its own documents, suggested this deal could be worth as little as $4 billion that would be spread across cities and counties, the U.S. government, and all of the states.
Yep.
And the other part of the problem with this proposal, Robin, is
briefly, if you can, yeah.
This settlement would rely on and be funded by future and continued opioid sales. Purdue would go into bankruptcy, the company would be restructured and continue on for a while. And I think in Massachusetts, at least, and I think across the nation, the families that have suffered and lost so much would be devastated to know that any settlement or resolution was going to be paid for by the continued sale of opioids.
Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey, thank you.
Great to be with you.
Okay, we'll follow that story. But let's take a break from the news right now. Recently, we had the chance to grab a few minutes with actors Ansel Elgort and Oakes Fegley when the two were at the Toronto Film Festival promoting their new movie, The Goldfinch, which opens tomorrow. They play older and younger versions of Theo and continued that mashup as we spoke.
This is Oakes.
And this is Oakes.
No, no. Wait,
this
let's try that again.
This is Oakes.
This is Ansel.
This is Ansel.
This is Oakes.
It's understandable. In The Goldfinch, we go back and forth through time. The Theos blend. The young Theo goes with his mother to an art museum in New York. There's a terrorist bombing. She is killed. He stumbles out, stunned, clutching a painting of a goldfinch. Then he ricochets from the upper-class home of a classmate to his deadbeat dad's place in Las Vegas. Flash forward, the adult Theo, Ansel Elgort, sells antiques, though, as we hear in the scene with a client played by Dennis O'Hare, maybe they're not antiques.
I want to talk about the piece you've already sold me.
The Aflac. It is beautiful, isn't it?
Yes. Except that it isn't, is it? Thomas Aflac, I mean. The Phoenix ornament is, I'm fairly certain about that, but the rest of the chest is not.
The Goldfinch is directed by John Crowley. It's based on Donna Tartt's beloved and best-selling Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. I asked Ansel Elgort first about the pressure.
I don't think there's any way we could live up to Donna Tartt's novel.
No.
Every sentence you hang on. I think I could read that book 100 times and not get tired of it.
Oakes, how about you? When you were asked to play the young Theo, what did you know of it?
Well, my mother had read the book previous, and she was a huge, huge fan. Still is a massive fan of Donna Tartt. And she talked about the book and how descriptive it was and how incredible it was. And so immediately, I was interested in the project and wanted to be a part of it.
Yeah. I hadn't read the book. And so I want to let listeners know that, especially if you haven't read the book, the twists and turns and the directions the film goes will be even more shocking to you. But Ansel, how would you describe Theo?
Broken, very self-aware, a actor, a man who's made many mistakes, doesn't know how to take them back, and is on like an avalanche of lies and regrets, but it just won't stop.
Among the mistakes, refer back to that masterpiece that Theo takes from the museum, The Goldfinch, which really exists. It hangs in The Hague. It was painted by Dutch artist Carol Peijters Fabricius, who himself was killed in a gunpowder explosion. But in the book and film, Theo takes the painting, something his mentor, Hobie, played by Jeffrey Wright, finds unforgivable.
Do you know that it was his last painting because he died? An explosion, stupid accident. And somehow, miracle after miracle, it survives through centuries. Until you.
Hobie, I never meant. I didn't know what it was at first. And then, I don't even know why I kept it. I was just trying to keep it safe.
It wasn't yours to keep!
And Oakes, how would you describe the young Theo?
I would say he's broken. He's just trying to crawl his way back to a normal life. And the reminder, the constant reminder of the painting being by his side is an incredibly difficult thing to break. And that bond that he has with the painting is never severed. So
yeah,
he is constantly trying to make sure he has an understanding of not only where the painting is, but the painting itself at all times.
Yeah, the stress of that. I mean, it's his rock, it's his addiction, it's his mother. And both of you, both Theos, are observers. I mean, any thoughts about that, playing observers?
I think Donna Tartt is such a great observer, and she wrote this book in first person from Theo's point of view, so we sort of get a bit of Donna in Theo.
As an observer, I think Theo is an incredibly... He can be incredibly quiet when he wants to be, and he's constantly looking at everything and everyone and judging everyone on first sight, which I think he ultimately might not be the best quality of him, but I think that's who he is.
The young Theo Oakes Fegley plays is in shock from living through that bombing and then being hauled to the foreclosed landscape of Las Vegas, where his dad dies and he's left with dad's uncaring girlfriend. Theo tells his only pal, we have to get back to New York.
I can't stay here. She'll put me in a home, you understand that? Look, I'm a minor. I've got no family, no friends out here. We have to go now.
You never really know where you're going to end up, but I've definitely grown as a person and grown creatively. I'm a lot more of an observer after playing Theo, I would say.
Ansel, how about you?
I'm just excited to do more work. I'm really excited to keep doing what I've been so lucky to be able to do with my life.
No kidding, your career is continuing. You're playing Tony in West Side Story.
Yes.
One of the most coveted roles. I mean, just how's that feeling?
It's awesome. It is a blast. It is crazy that I'm playing in a musical. I love musicals. Musicals, that's how I got into this also. I'm enjoying every moment of it.
The Goldfinch stars Ansel Elgort and Oakes Fegley. The film opens in theaters tomorrow.
Search and rescue efforts continue in the Bahamas nearly 2 weeks after Hurricane Dorian made landfall there. Bahamian Prime Minister Hubert Minnis addressed the public last night.
There are many who are still missing. The number of deaths is expected to significantly increase.
So far, there have been at least 50 people confirmed dead, and 1,300 others are missing. Joining us now for the latest from NASA is CNN's Paula Newton. Paula, what do we know so far about efforts to find the missing?
Well, you know, they have been scouring really all the islands. Remember, you're talking about several hundred miles scattered about islands that are in some cases very large, in some cases quite small, just a few miles across. And for that reason, it was started with the U.S. Coast Guard. We certainly saw them do many rescues when I was on the island. But obviously, as this has worn on, they start to look at the missing persons list and start to try and really assess where could these people be. So trying to pinpoint exactly where they were living, if perhaps they died, in fact, in their own homes. The issue, though, that has been so terrifying for so many families is that when that storm surge came through, they saw with their own eyes, in some cases, neighbors, relatives, be really taken out to sea by the storm surge, drown. And as the water has receded, they have looked for their family members and have not been able to find them. I think what's so heartbreaking, Jeremy, is that, of course, a lot of those people that I met are waiting to find their relatives. They think perhaps by some miracle they'll run into them during evacuation on a ferry or on a shelter here in Nassau. So they don't want to give up hope. And yet now we're so far into this disaster that they're really wondering if their lives will ever be put back together again, given all of that they've lost.
What about the people who have been found or who have made their way to shelter in some way? Where are they now? What's the status of those people who maybe have lost their homes, but where do they go?
So most of the people have been evacuated to shelters here to the Capitol, and they have several scattered throughout the city. They are crowded and in some cases lacking for things that they want, especially for families. But what the Bahamian government wants is for families to begin to take some of these other families in. The Bahamian prime minister and his wife have taken in a family as well. But other than that, beyond daily survival, they're also wondering about how to start again. And a lot of that involves finding jobs. Nassau was already really struggling with overdevelopment. So a lot of the people from the Abacos, and I guess some from Grand Bahama as well, know that and are wondering what's here for them now, especially since they know their homes have been flattened and they have nothing to return to.
What about the people who have been coming to the U.S. or trying to come to the U.S.? There's been a lot of back and forth from the Trump administration about whether those people will be allowed in. The latest is that they will need passports and visas in order to get to the U.S. What's the latest on that?
Well, the latest from the U.S. government is that the Bahamians will not be given temporary status, so they cannot come to the United States to remain. If they want to come in, they will have to come in under all the old rules. And what were those? They would normally need a visa. There was a process in place that was at the discretion of the U.S. government as they were leaving the Bahamas that they could get a visa waiver with just their passport and a criminal background check that was given to them by the Bahamian police. You know, from the first moments I arrived in the storm, you would have people thinking, okay, how do I get a hold of that criminal background check? Because that will allow me to go to the United States where I have relatives or friends. That has been spotty now, and it's been unreliable. Again, it is at the discretion of American authorities. And so anecdotally, we've heard a lot of people that have not been able to enter the United States unless they have the visa, which in certain cases did not happen previously. The other thing I will say, though, is that there are a lot of dual Bahamian U.S. citizens, and hundreds of them are already gone back to the United States and are now trying to consider whether they just remain in the United States or come back to the Bahamas.
Well, and I can imagine just logistically, if you're in the middle of a terrible hurricane and your house is destroyed, a passport would not be the first thing that I would pick up. So a lot of them probably lost those documents.
Yeah, it was heartening to hear, though, Jeremy, that a lot of them had what they called these go bags, and they would make sure that they were sealed and kept them from water. And Jeremy, I can't tell you the struggles that I heard from people actually swimming with their go envelopes and their go bags, knowing that when they got to dry land, if they survived that storm surge, which in some cases was over 25 feet, that they knew they needed those documents. In some cases, that's all they have.
Now, Paula, there is a tropical system that is in the area that may form in the Bahamas in the next day or so into a tropical depression or even a tropical storm. What are you hearing about that?
We are hearing a lot about that. And of course, that is going to frustrate recovery efforts. And a lot of that does involve recovering bodies because they want to be able to give these people a proper burial and give their family some type of closure so that they can identify them properly. You have to think about people who have just put a flimsy tarp on the top of their home, hoping to stay there, to hear that winds and rain are again coming. You just don't need it. And obviously, keeping in mind, we are in the middle of the hurricane season still, and they are definitely looking out to sea, wondering what's next.
That is Paula Newton with CNN. She's speaking to us from Nassau in the Bahamas. Paula, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.